WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sometimes on Fresh Air, the stories we hear make us wonder how we would respond if fate were to test us, or we marvel at how someone has put himself at personal risk to help others. In this final week of 1993, we're featuring interviews recorded this year with people who inspired us. Today we'll hear from Terry Anderson. He was the Western hostage held the longest time in captivity in the Middle East. This year, Anderson published a memoir telling the story many of us hoped he would live to tell. Later, the doctor who is said to know more about war surgery than any other person, Chris Yanu. He's worked in a Palestinian refugee camp under constant siege, and in Somalia, where he set up field hospitals. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has named an expert on Russia to serve as his deputy at the State Department. At a news conference in Los Angeles, Christopher named former journalist Strobe Talbot to serve in the second-ranking position on the administration's foreign policy team. Talbot is a former Washington bureau chief for Time magazine. He's fluent in Russian and is known as a strong advocate of U.S. support for Russian President Boris Yeltsin. If he's confirmed by the Senate, Talbot would replace Clifton Wharton, who resigned last month under pressure after criticism of the administration's policies in Bosnia, Somalia, and Haiti. Nearly all ethics charges against Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison were dismissed in Austin today. Bill Zeeble of member station KERA has more.
Judge John Onion Jr. said indictments Hutchison committed official misconduct, tampered with physical evidence, and governmental records were too vague, so he accepted defense motions to drop them. But he also gave prosecutors 10 days to amend those indictments. They charged Hutchison with ethics violations during her 2.5 years as state treasurer. The judge did uphold one indictment of official misconduct. He hasn't yet decided if he'll move Hutchison's trial from Austin, which her attorneys requested. All along, Hutchison's denied the charges against her, saying they're politically motivated. Senator Hutchison defeated Democrat Bob Krueger this summer in a special election. It was held to fill Treasury Secretary Lloyd Benson's vacant Senate seat. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
A commission investigating police corruption in New York City has released a preliminary report. The so-called Mullen Commission has been looking into allegations of drug dealing, brutality, and cover-ups by the police department. Laura Seidel of member station WBGO reports.
As many had expected, the commission is recommending an outside agency be set up to monitor the police department. Judge Milton Mullen, who headed the investigation, says it's clear that the department's internal affairs division can't do the job.
For a period of years, there were numerous allegations of corruption about certain police officers, and yet the IAD was incompetent to ferret out the corruption and to bring charges against the corrupt police officers.
Mullen reiterated what had come up numerous times during the hearings, that a protective blue wall of silence exists among police officers, which keeps them from turning each other in. But Mullen says he's not suggesting that the city create another agency. Instead, he would like to see a regular commission made up of volunteers. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Seidel reporting.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about a point today to set another record, 3,793.77. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index gained a fraction for its second record close in a row. This is NPR News. There was more fighting today in South Lebanon between Israeli forces and Arab guerrillas who opposed the Palestinian self-rule agreement. The Israeli military said its warplanes attacked guerrilla positions in South Lebanon today after the guerrillas fired rockets and mortar shells into Israeli-occupied land along the border. Security sources in Lebanon said at least two guerrillas were killed in the Israeli air raids. Late today, the sources were reporting that Hezbollah launched a series of retaliatory attacks on positions held by Israeli forces in their paid militia, the South Lebanon Army. A new survey finds that consumer confidence in the economy has shot up this month. Gene Brian Johnson of member station WNYC reports from New York.
The study finds that the Consumer Confidence Index for December reached a level of 80 out of a base of 100, the second straight monthly increase. It was conducted by the Conference Board, a business research group. A spokesman said the index is now at a level, quote, historically associated with a reasonably comfortable pace of economic growth. Consumer spending fuels two-thirds of national economic activity, and the level of consumer expectations is often used as an indicator of the future. The Conference Board said there was a gain in those who believe business conditions will be better 6 months from now, and a decrease in those who feel conditions will be worse. But the study of 5,000 households also shows that consumers are pessimistic about job opportunities. For National Public Radio, this is Gene Brian Johnson in New York.
The nation's biggest long-distance phone company announced plans today to raise some domestic and international phone rates. Subject to approval by federal regulators, AT&T said it's raising the cost of direct-dialed domestic phone calls an average of 6.3%. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During this final week of the year, we're listening back to conversations with some of the more remarkable people who appeared on our show in 1993. Terry Anderson was the longest-held Western hostage in Lebanon. During his captivity, we all wondered what happens to a human being when he spends the better part of 7 years blindfolded and chained to a wall. Who would have believed one could maintain such grace, eloquence, and clear-sightedness as Anderson managed to? Anderson was the Middle East correspondent for the Associated Press when he was kidnapped in Beirut on March 16, 1985. His captors were Muslim fundamentalists who described themselves as members of the Islamic Jihad. Anderson's fiancée, Madeleine Basile, was 6 months pregnant when he was captured. Now they're married and live with their daughter in a suburb of New York City. This year, Anderson and Basile co-authored a book called Den of Lions, Memoirs of 7 Years. Basile was in the studio with Anderson when I interviewed him last October. Anderson told me he's still determined to forgive his captors, and he thinks he's making progress.
It's something that you work on fairly often every time you think about it, and probably will go on for a long time. But it's something that we have to do for two reasons. We're Christians, and we're required to, and because I'm not going to let it affect my life. If I stay angry, if I stay bitter over what happened, it's not going to hurt them. It's only going to hurt me and the people around me. I have a very good life right now. I'm very happy right now. I don't want that to be harmed in any way.
You wrote that you sometimes wondered if your captors thought you were a human being. How do you think your guards rationalized your captivity?
I don't know, really. We talked, and there were things that we could understand a bit about each other, but there was always a limit. There was always a point that you reached and said, you know, I simply can't understand this. These are very religious people. These are people who pray five times a day. They're fundamentalist Muslims. I've read the Quran. I know something about Islam. There's no place in Islam that I can find that justifies that kind of treatment of another human being. I can't understand how anyone who believes, as they do, in a merciful and compassionate God can possibly believe that kidnapping and murder are pleasing to that merciful and compassionate God. You can't understand.
Did they seem scared, too?
Yeah, some of them were pretty scared. They were young men. What they were doing was dangerous. They are not frontline soldiers. I can't say that they're very courageous. It doesn't take a great deal of courage to kidnap unarmed people and chain them to the wall. So, they were scared. They were scared of us, quite often.
What were they afraid that you could do to them?
Well, we were all much larger than they were. They were relatively small young men, and they were scared that we would do something violent. Every time you moved quickly, you could see them jump. And for quite a long time.
Did you consider it? Did you consider doing
that?
Sure,
of course we considered it. Of course we did. I decided against it. I thought it was foolish.
Why?
I was chained.
Uh-huh.
Suppose I grabbed a guard, took his gun, and shot him. What am I going to do then?
Uh-huh.
Rip my chain out of the wall? There were times when I thought there might have been a chance, but I waited and rejected it. I didn't want to get killed. And had I managed to throttle a guard, and I would have had probably to kill one to get away, which meant, of course, that I had better get away, and gotten through the locks on the doors, if we didn't happen to be chained at that particular moment, can you imagine what would have happened to a very pale-skinned white male running down the street in a pair of white boxer shorts in the middle of a fundamentalist Shiite neighborhood?
That's an interesting image.
I didn't think there was any real chance to escape, so I didn't try. Had there been a chance, I'd have been gone, believe me.
You know, and yet you ask yourself in the book, you know, have we, the hostages, been tamed? Have we become meek, well-mannered little hostages? Are we accepting this assault on our dignity? Did you ask yourself a lot and wonder, like, is it a bad thing that you're doing what you're told and that
sure.
you're,
Look,
you're following
it's always,
the orders and accepting it? Yeah.
It's always a challenge to your manhood, and different things challenged each of us more directly or more intimately. You always had to ask yourself, when I talk to these young men reasonably, when I treat them like normal human beings, when I'm reasonably polite, is that giving in? Should I show them how angry I am? Should I show them how much I hate what they're doing? Should I be hostile? Brian Keenan was always hostile.
He's the one who was supposed to have the great sense of humor.
Oh, he did. But he could never bring himself to deal with these people in any way except, I hate you and I want you to know I hate you. He would occasionally try to keep relations on a reasonable basis, but he just couldn't bring himself to do it. He's a Irishman with a temper and a nationalist. And in Northern Ireland, the way they conceive of dealing with your enemy is with open defiance. And that's what he did. And he paid for it. He paid dearly for it.
With punishment?
Oh, yes. He was severely beaten many, many times.
Were you beaten a lot?
Not a lot. I was thumped around the first year and a half or so. And then they stopped. I don't know why they did, because they continued to assault some of the others, but they left me alone.
You said everybody had the thing that most challenged their manhood. What was that thing for you?
The worst thing was not reacting, not leaping to the defense of Brian when he was beaten. Chained and taped and beaten beside me. I was chained also. There isn't anything I really could have done. And we knew by then that the best reaction when they went into these rages, which they did from time to time, was just to curl up and wait it out. Because if you defied them, they just went further over the wall and you could get seriously hurt. Whereas if you offered no resistance, they would eventually stop. But to lie there and listen to a close friend and companion being beaten while you do nothing, even if you know it's the right thing to do, is a pretty disgusting, humiliating experience.
Did you watch or did you look away?
I was blindfolded.
Oh, sure.
You couldn't watch, but you could hear.
Terry, I want to ask you, when during the 7 years that you were held hostage, how much of that time were you chained to the wall?
We were chained the first 4.5 months, and then we were put in a place where they did not keep us on a chain. They merely kept locks on the doors. There were several of us in the room for a year. Then we went to another basement cell, where the cells were only 6 feet square and 6 feet high, so we hardly needed a chain. We were put on chains again in January 1987, when Terry Waite was kidnapped. And we remained chained from January of 1987 until December of 1991. So
there were 4 years in a row,
yeah,
of being chained.
We were never off the chain, except to go to the bathroom.
Did you have your choice of which leg was chained?
Yeah, it depended. You sometimes would have the choice of whether your ankle was chained or whether your wrist was chained, you know, which foot you'd put it on. Sometimes you wouldn't, depended on where we were.
What? How would you choose?
Oh, ankle's better than wrist, no problem.
Why is the ankle better?
Well, because you can stand up, you can take two paces in each direction if it's a 5-foot chain. If it's on your wrist, then you can't walk and you can't stand up. They chained my wrist there for a year and a half with Tom. And that was a year and a half, you couldn't stand up.
Well, what happened to your legs during that period?
And I got pretty weak. I got fat, actually, because they were giving us a lot of rice and stuff. And I put on weight.
That must have felt really odd, gaining weight.
It felt very odd. We didn't have very much to do except eat whatever they gave us.
How are your legs and arms now?
I'm in pretty good shape. I jog most mornings and have a set of weights and I do some weightlifting. I'm in fair shape.
My guest is Terry Anderson, who was the longest-held Western hostage in Lebanon. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Terry Anderson. You read the Bible a lot inside.
I did indeed.
But you write that you'd actually been becoming more Catholic before you became a hostage, that you were already starting to, like, rethink your faith and to, become more involved with your faith after having left the religion.
I rejoined the church. That's not strictly exactly right, because I was always a Catholic. Mm-hmm. It was just for a long time during my life I denied that and rejected it. And what happened was I simply accepted it again as a fact. I'm a Catholic. I'm a Christian. This is what I believe. And that means I'm going to have to do certain things. And I was trying to figure out exactly what those things might be.
When Father Jenko was taken hostage, you asked to say confession.
Mm-hmm.
To him, and the guards kind of reluctantly let you do it. Did you try to make that as meaningful a confession as possible? I mean, was this just a way to talk with him, or did you really want it to be the real thing, a real confession which you hadn't made in many years?
It was the real thing. It was extremely meaningful. Look, much of the Catholic faith involves ritual. I like that. I'm comfortable with it. Obviously, the core of the faith is very personal and has to do with a belief in God. But the ritual is there for a reason. And it's a lovely thing, and at times it serves very strong purposes. That's true with confession, certainly, with formal confession. I felt a need to talk to my confessor, the only one who was handy. It was a very emotional time. It was very necessary for me at that particular time. It was very meaningful.
It's kind of interesting, you in the position of, you know, innocent victim confessing your sins.
Well, there were quite a few that needed confessing.
There was one point where the guard said that one of you, one of the hostages, and I think there were five of you in the room then, were going to be released.
Mm-hmm.
And the group of hostages was asked to choose which one it was going to be. What an awkward position. And you suggested yourself as the
well,
one.
Well, everybody wanted to go home.
Yeah.
And that was the starting point. Everybody deserved to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that was put to us, we need somebody, we're going to let somebody go, and his job is going to go out and be a spokesman and try to persuade the government to negotiate, to begin negotiations. And the choice was, you know, who do we think we should send to do that? And we had discussion and had a vote, and they chose me, and it was all a joke.
What was all a joke?
Well,
you mean because they didn't respect that anyway?
Well, they had never intended to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very cruel hoax. Ben Weir went home in the end, which was proper and correct, Ben Weir being the longest held and the oldest, and he should have gone home.
What was it like for you to feel that you would be the best representative and to vote for yourself, knowing that, you know, on some level one should be...
That's not quite how it worked out.
Yeah, let me let you explain that.
Father Martin and Ben Weir both eliminated themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They said they didn't want to go. And the chief said that Tom Sutherland could not be the one chosen. He was eliminated by them. We discussed it and we said, well, we're just going to ignore their strictures. If we're going to choose, we'll choose who we believe we should choose, whether it's Father Martin or Ben Weir or Tom or anybody else. And then we put our choices down on a piece of paper, secret ballot kind of thing. And the first time everybody voted for somebody else, and it came out, everybody got a vote. And then the second time, it came out, there were about five ballots, and it came down to David and I. And I voted for myself. So did David. In the end, it finally came down to unanimous choice on me. It was a very, very difficult time. And I don't know, what can I tell you? It was very hard.
How did you feel when the guards came back after you were voted the one to be released? The guards came back and said, no, it can't be Terry Anderson.
Okay, how do you imagine I felt? I had prepared myself for that, I thought, but it was still a very great shock, because when something like that happens, no matter how you try not to believe something or try to say this is not going to happen the way you expect, you still do believe it in yourself. So it was a great disappointment. Of course it was a great shock.
What were the times when you were most afraid of losing your sanity?
Oh, there were a few times when I thought I was going to lose it. There was a time when I began to lose it and began beating my head against the wall, beat it bloody, and they had to pull me down and chain me up again. There were one or two others. There was a time in solitary confinement for a while, in a very bad place, no lights, and no books or anything in the cell, when I thought I was going to lose it. I was going crazy, but it ended, and I managed to get through. That's a strange thing, you know. I keep coming back to this. Terry Waite spent 3.5 years in solitary confinement with no other input, no books, nothing, no contact with anybody, nothing to think about, only his head. And when he joined us, he was sane. I spent less than a year in solitary confinement altogether, and it nearly destroyed me. And different things affect men differently.
When you were beating your head against the wall during that period, did you have any idea what you were doing?
I was just trying to make it stop. The thoughts in my head were going round and round and round, and I felt I was losing control of my own brain, and I was just trying to make it stop.
What kind of thoughts were going around?
Oh, lots of crazy thoughts.
Terry, can I ask you how it felt? Forgive me for asking, but what did it feel like when you got your freedom?
Well, you can imagine what it felt like. I mean, it was an enormous joy. I was really kind of on a high for a long time. I still am, actually.
Yeah, does that last? I've always wondered if that lasts, or if this incredible depression sets in afterwards when you realize what's been taken away.
hasn't been any depression. There have been some difficult times. We've had some adjustments to make, and we've had to work on some things. But no, I've never been depressed about it.
Terry, to write the memoir, you asked for your Freedom of Information Act files. You had a great article about this in the New York Times a while back where you said that you were afraid it would take more time for you to get your files and than you spent held hostage. Did you learn anything that really surprised you from what you did get in the files and
from
what came back uncensored?
Zero.
Zero?
I have yet to obtain a single useful or interesting fact out of all the stuff they've sent me. 80% of the stuff they're sending me under the Freedom of Information Act is news stories.
that have
been declassified, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I don't know who classified them in the first place, but I got a stack of AP stories. I've gotten nothing useful. I have turned over all... I'm still getting material, and I will for years, because I've turned over all my requests and appeals of those requests to National Security Archives, which is a group of people who have pro bono lawyers in Washington, and this is what they do.
Yeah, this is their specialty.
They pursue freedom of information requests on behalf of people who don't have time or resources to do it, and then they put all the information that they get into a data bank, which everybody has access to. That's how I got Ali North's diaries. They had pursued a long, difficult legal battle to get Ali's diaries, and then I went there and they gave them to me for my book.
Speaking of Ali North, how did you feel when you found out about the arms for hostages deal?
Oh, well, I think it was a mistake, and we thought so in there. We thought it was a bad deal. It didn't work. I got three hostages released, and I got a bunch more captured. I told Ali North that when I met him, by the way. I interviewed him several times. I like Ali North. I like him personally. He's a very personable man. He's a warm man. And there's no question whatsoever that he, as well as Ronald Reagan and George Bush and all the other people involved, were personally dedicated to getting us out. I mean, they really cared about us. Ronald Reagan cared so much that he ignored the strongest sort of advice from his top advisors, who said, "Mr. President, you can't do this." And he said, "I don't care. I want them out." These people really cared about what they were doing, and I can hardly criticize him for that. I think the...
You're not cynical about their motives for wanting the hostages, really?
No,
not
no.
The motives, no.
No, not the motives. I think they made some bad judgments, mm-hmm. and they certainly handled it badly. And it didn't work. There were no books telling them how to do this. There were no rules. But it's really not very simple. I mean, not very difficult. It's fairly simple to understand that when you pay for hostages, you simply promote the kidnapping of more people. And that's what happened. After that rather bizarre period, they went back to a policy that actually did, in the end, work. It took a long time. It took a long time, not least because of the Arms for Hostages incident. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan was saying, "I will not bargain with terrorists." And all the time he's bargaining with terrorists, and they know it. And then a little while later, they say, "We're not going to bargain with terrorists, and we mean it this time." It takes a while to convince the terrorists.
Right.
And that's what happened. But eventually they did believe it. And eventually they did let us go. So in the end, they got it right. We came home. We didn't pay them anything, which is about as best thing you can hope for.
Terry Anderson, recorded in October of this year with his wife Madeline Basile. Their memoir about his years in captivity is called Den of Lions. Terry Anderson recently organized a political reform group called New York Renaissance that met for the first time this month in Albany. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dr. Chris Yanu says medicine for him is not an occupation, it's a calling. And he's been called to practice in some of the most devastated and war-torn parts of the world. He's worked in a Palestinian refugee camp and was the director of surgical operations for the Red Cross in Somalia. Coming up, we feature an interview with Dr. Yanu as part of our 1993 Fresh Air retrospective.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In its latest move to strengthen the Clinton administration's foreign policy team, Strobe Talbott has been nominated to the number two post at the State Department. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Talbott has been serving as U.S. Ambassador-at-Large to the former Soviet Union. Assuming he wins Senate confirmation as Deputy Secretary of State, he'll continue to be the administration's principal architect of policy toward Russia while taking on other substantive assignments from Secretary of State Warren Christopher. Talbott was chosen over several more experienced diplomats for the deputy position. He is 47 and, until this year, worked as a foreign affairs journalist for Time magazine. Secretary Christopher.
My choice was quite deliberate. It seemed to me it is very desirable to have someone who brings the vigor and drive, aggressiveness of youth.
Talbott is a longtime personal friend of Bill Clinton's and is expected to have more influence than most previous deputy secretaries. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary says that she believes some of those people subjected to radiation testing in the 1940s and 1950s are due government compensation. Appearing on CNN, the secretary said up to 800 people were involved in these experiments, and some apparently did not give their informed consent. Government research took place during the Cold War years to try and help gauge the effects of radiation on humans. A blast of Arctic cold is being blamed for at least 7 deaths in 4 states and for work and travel slowdowns from the plains to the Atlantic coast. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
At least 3 of those who died, 2 in New York and 1 in Ohio, were homeless men, and temporary shelters in many parts of the nation are operating near capacity, as they have since temperatures dropped to below normal on Christmas Eve. While the present cold snap is not setting records everywhere, it's still more than cold enough for communities accustomed to more moderate temperatures along the Gulf of Mexico and the mid-Atlantic states. Major airports in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. were closed for a few hours because of snow, and many government workers in the nation's capital went home early. One agency that's not getting a break is the National Weather Service. Forecasters there expect the chill to hang on until the end of this week. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher has downplayed a recent statement by China indicating its opposition to U.N. sanctions against North Korea. Chinese officials have reportedly told U.N. Secretary General Boutros-Ghali that North Korea's opposition to outside inspections of its nuclear sites should be resolved by negotiations. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than 1 point to close at 3,793. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, several hundred people have left Sarajevo in U.N.-protected convoys. 8 buses left the capital under U.N. protection, and other people are still waiting to leave. In the past, similar efforts have been stopped by fighting or red tape. Most of those leaving are women and children and the elderly, some of whom have been waiting for months for safe passage. Moving civilians is a private effort with aid from the U.N. and the Red Cross. U.N. officials have accused all the warring factions with blocking these efforts, along with stopping food and medicine from getting through to those who need it. Meanwhile, heavy fighting is reported in central Bosnia, some 20 miles from the capital. Reports from Lebanon say at least 2 Muslim guerrillas were killed and 3 injured in Israeli air raids in southern Lebanon today. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Despite ongoing Israeli PLO negotiations, Israel's northern border with Lebanon shows no sign of peace. Israeli warplanes today three times bombed targets of the pro-Iranian Hezbollah guerrilla group, which opposes the peace process. The Israeli raids were in response to Hezbollah's shelling of Israeli positions in the area Israel calls its security zone. Hezbollah also responded with several hours of artillery and Katyusha rockets to the first Israeli air raid. On a tour of South Lebanon, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said Syria could do more to lessen Hezbollah's attacks. Rabin also said the security zone is vital for protecting Israel's northern settlements and that Israel has no intention of leaving. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The conference board says that consumer confidence rose to its highest point this year in December. The private business research group says consumer confidence climbed to 80.2% from 71.9% in November. The board uses 1985 as a base of 100 for its study. Since October, the survey has gone up 20 points. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. On this last week of 1993, we're featuring a retrospective of interviews with some of the remarkable people who've joined us over the past year. Dr. Chris Yanu performs surgery far away from the sterilized hospital rooms he was trained in. Dr. Yanu is among the world's most respected war surgeons. He's repaired gruesome war wounds in makeshift hospitals while under fire. He spent most of 1992 in Somalia, directing surgical operations for the International Committee of the Red Cross. From 1985 to 87, he was the only surgeon for the Palestinian refugee camp of Shatila in Beirut. He recently wrote a book about his experiences there called Besieged. Dr. Yanu grew up in Toronto, the son of Greek Macedonian immigrants. He's lived in third world countries for over 20 years. I spoke to him in February of this year after he completed his Red Cross assignment in Somalia. He told me how war surgery compares to civilian surgery.
A war wound by definition is dirty and contaminated. And therefore, what you do with it is wound excision, a debridement. You have to cut out all of the devitalized tissue, all of the muscle that has been damaged. If you leave it in, there's a danger of infection, even gangrene. So you cut it all out, and you leave the wound open. You don't close the skin. You put on a dressing, which you leave untouched for 4 or 5 days. On the fifth day, you open it up under anesthesia. The wound should be clean if you've done a good debridement, and it's at that point and that point only that you close the skin. If you close it immediately on the first day, you have a very, very high risk of infection and with an abscess formation or septicemia, and that is the big danger.
Oh, I imagine, you know, if you have a war wound and you're living in war circumstances, it's hard to keep the dressing clean. I mean, you might not even be able to stay in the hospital. There might not be a bed for you to stay in.
Well, the important point is this. The natural physiological resistance of the person. Too many doctors, especially surgeons, my colleagues, tend to think that they heal their patients. We don't. We help the human body to heal itself. That's very important. Too many doctors play at God. There is the natural resistance. I mean, we've had wars now for tens of thousands of years, and there have been wounded all throughout recorded and unrecorded history. There were no doctors, and yet not every wounded patient died or suffered a complication. So there is the natural defense of the organism, and what we try to do is help the organism really to heal itself. You cut out the devitalized tissues. Even under very difficult conditions of hygiene, you would be surprised how few wounds get infected if your surgery is correct.
What were sanitary conditions like in the various operating rooms that you came across in Somalia?
Well, at times it was an ordinary house. I mean, if the hospital itself had been destroyed, it was an ordinary house that we would take over with the agreement of the community, the elders, the medical staff. And just a question of washing down the floor with soap and water, pulling in the kitchen table and then operating. The windows, of course, are open, and you spend more time chasing the flies than anything else.
Well, let me stop you there. Isn't that pretty dangerous if a fly lands on an incision?
Well, again, the wound, war wounds, are dirty and contaminated by definition. And, of course, but there are no windows, there's nothing else to do, and you don't get infections by simply having a fly, drop on a wound. also in certain parts of the world, in South Asia, maggots are purposely introduced into infected wounds.
Why?
Because a maggot will only eat necrotic tissue, dead tissue, and performs a very good debridement and effect a wound excision. Now, it might not be very comfortable psychologically for the individual, but after a couple of weeks of having maggots in a wound, the wound is quite clean, actually.
Have you tried that as a procedure?
I've not tried it myself. I've read about it on a couple of occasions, and I have seen incidences where that has occurred without it being willed, that wounds have been infestated with maggots and so forth. And when you open them, if that process has been going on long enough, you find that it's quite clean. And once it is clean, the maggots leave. They do not eat live tissue, only dead tissue. So when there's no more food left for them, they fall out of the wound, actually. But you can operate under those conditions, and we had no problems. And with fresh wounds, as you say, wounds that are less than 6 hours old, and, well, I performed perhaps about 1,000 operations in Somalia over the year and supervised another 1,500 of my Somali colleagues. Of the vast majority were fresh wounds, I would say. Of those fresh wounds, we had an infection rate of only 1 or 2%.
Wow, that's really low considering the circumstances you were operating under.
Again, one of the big problems in the West, in North America, with infections in hospitals is that hospitals are hermetically sealed structures. And you cultivate a bacterial flora in the hospital that takes out all of the bacterial strains that are sensitive to antibiotics. And what you have left in the hospital is bacteria that are resistant to all antibiotics. And that's the big problem with bacterial infections in North American hospitals, that it's normally a bacteria that would not cause an infection, but because the rest of the bacterial flora are no longer there, you select out these strains that are resistant to just about every antibiotic known. In the third world, hospitals have open doors and windows, and there is a continuous change of the bacterial flora in the hospital, and therefore no selection of bacterial strains. And you never get these raging epidemics due to Pseudomonas that you find in North American hospitals.
My guest is war surgeon Dr. Chris Yanu. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with war surgeon Dr. Chris Yanu. You must have a lot of experience talking to young, arrogant men with guns. What are some of the techniques you've learned over the years, how to talk yourself out of situations where someone is holding a gun on you?
It depends on how well I know the young men. I've been in very, very different situations where I've been, I was known, I was not known. And obviously when they know you, then it's a totally different situation, and somebody is sitting there with a gun shooting and he's angry and so forth, and you tell them, look, you want to shoot? Shoot me. And of course, the fellow is shocked, and then you start dealing with him on that basis. Now, if the fellow doesn't know you, you don't tell him, you want to shoot somebody, shoot me. That's not the way to handle that situation. I think the important thing to realize is that war is one thing, that when you are shooting, even from a distance, that there's a certain, that there's a psychological distanciation as well. Whereas when you are face to face with someone, and this young, angry man who perhaps has just lost a friend or a close member of the family, and is really torn apart, I mean, it is that person who is weak, and they simply happen to have a gun. And at that point, what you try is not to be provocative, but to empathize and try to work on a basis that you show yourself not to be a danger to that person.
Can you give us an example of a situation like that?
Well, there was one that I speak about in the book. I was director of the hospital in Shatila, and I had one fellow who wanted to marry one of the patients in the hospital. It was a woman who had been injured, and I had operated on her a couple of times. And her mother, brother, agreed. So he's visiting his fiancée in the hospital. The uncle disagreed. The uncle did not want the marriage. So they had a couple of arguments, knives shooting at each other and so forth. They ran out into the alleyways of Shatila, each went to get his Kalashnikov. The young fellow comes back looking for the uncle to shoot him. And I stop in front of him, and he fires a shot over my head. And I tell this fellow, Sherbal, you want to shoot? Then shoot me. And his eyes just went blank, and he said, what the hell am I doing here? And then he came to himself again. He turned around and ran off. He comes back a few minutes later, and that first time was with a revolver. Now he comes back with his AK-47. Hmm. I stop him again, and a couple of fellows come to help me, and I talk him down, and they get his gun away from him. But again, he runs off, and he still has his revolver. And while he runs past an alleyway, he and the uncle spy each other, and he shoots with his revolver, and the uncle replies with a whole magazine from his Kalashnikov. And that's 30 bullets. There were 2 dead and 15 wounded.
Wow.
Now, that's the sort of situation that you get when you're living under siege in Shatila, which is only 200 yards by 200 yards, and after 6 months of shelling and bombing, etc., there are only 100 yards by 100 yards left. And look, if you treat people like animals, they're going to react like animals.
You, when you were in Shatila, the refugee camp was under siege for, I think, 134 consecutive days at one point?
That was one battle. I mean, it was under siege for about 2.5 years. And during that time, there were a series of battles, one of which lasted 5-6 months. And during the battle, nothing gets in, nothing gets out. It's totally sealed off.
I'm sure one thing that came into the hospital was a lot of danger, you know, seriously injured people. How do you perform triage in during a battle that lasts 134 days when you're the only surgeon in the camp?
Well, I was not the only doctor, and I had a half dozen Palestinian and Lebanese colleagues with me. And I, over the various battles that occurred before that, I trained them in the basics of war surgery. Some surgical gestures that they could perform themselves, putting in a chest tube, debridements of minor wounds and so forth. So I did the major surgery. Now, triage is triage. And you have your rules. You have a category of patients. The first are those that need surgery, urgent surgery. And where can you can expect very good results. And then you have patients who need surgery, but who can wait for surgery without really suffering any consequences. You have mildly injured patients, and then you have those that would require so much time and so much effort that you would put into risk the lives of some of the others. Fine, so you make out your categories and you begin. It's one of the most difficult decisions to make in medical practice. You do it.
Does anybody ever hold a gun to you and say, treat my son or treat my mother or else I'll kill you?
That's happened.
What did you say?
It's all part of triage. At that point, that's your category number one. It would be stupid to negotiate under those circumstances. And I have performed surgery with the barrel of a gun stuck between my ribs, and you do it. And then afterwards, of course, the fellow comes back and he's apologetic and this, and, you know, please forgive me and so forth. Terrific. You're going on to your second patient. But at that point, your triage says that that's number one, and you do it. And once you get it finished, then you can get on with the rest of your work.
Did you find that having a gun pointed at you affected your performance?
No, I have good powers of concentration. And usually in those cases, in effect, the patient is not that seriously injured. And so your operation takes very, very little time, and you get it done quickly, and it's not a difficult operation.
My guest is Dr. Chris Yanu, a war surgeon who works with the International Committee of the Red Cross. More with Dr. Yanu in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, the president's college roommate, Strobe Talbott, will be the new number two at the State Department. That appointment was made today. Refugees are being taken out of Sarajevo and away from the suffering the winter season is causing there. The Justice Department is suing the state of Illinois under the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll have more of Nina Totenberg's conversations with Justice Blackmun today. And we'll be looking at some new words for the 90s. The Random House Dictionary is out, and it includes words this time like dweeb.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with Dr. Chris Yanu. He's a war surgeon who's worked at a Palestinian refugee camp in Beirut and was the Red Cross's director of surgical operations in Somalia. How do you decide when it's time for you to leave a place? Why did you leave Somalia last month?
Somalia was basically because my mission had come to an end, and I had already extended a couple of times at the request of ICRC.
Mm-hmm.
After my experiences in Lebanon, and I had been through fighting in Beirut and the Israeli invasion and the fighting in the north and then back in the refugee camp, I stayed in Shatila for 27 months without leaving once, 200 yards by 200 yards. And when I got out, I needed to get out. And as I say in the book, I had to leave. I couldn't leave. I left and yet no. In some way, Shatila and I remained together. And it is the moral boundaries of Shatila that allow me to go to places like Cambodia and Somalia. And what I have learned is that if I'm going to be efficient as a surgeon and useful to my patients, that I have to pull back at a certain time, that no matter how obsessive a situation is, you come to a point where you've got to take some distance, pull back, get out, change your ideas. I usually change my ideas in New York's jazz bars. and then, after a couple of months of that, you're ready to go back again.
What's the point between basic depression, disillusionment, hunger, and exhaustion? What's the difference between that and knowing that it's really time to get out?
Well, first of all, you're not indispensable. You have to realize that. I mean, there are other people who are coming in and will replace you. No problem. You have to know. I mean, and also, I was doing a great deal of training.
Mm-hmm.
Now, teaching, as any teacher will tell you, is a very repetitive process. And that's why school holidays are so long, usually. So if I'm visiting 10 different hospitals in each place, I'm teaching the local staff how to do sterilization. Now, for them, it's the first time they've heard it. They're interested. But by the 10th time you repeat it, you're sick and tired of what you're saying. You're no longer fresh. You're getting bored with what you're doing. And that's a good time to pull back as well.
Do you ever get bored of surgery?
I don't get bored with surgery, although I do get angry and frustrated at times. I think the best example was in Shatila. And it was simply that people were so frustrated themselves that they then started doing stupid things, putting themselves at risk, or going through areas that were open to sniper fire. And because they were simply too lazy to go through a trench where they would be protected from sniper fire, and they were above in a exposed area, they would be shot. And another wounded patient would come back into the hospital and I would have to operate. And finally, you know, I would sit there and pull at my hair and scream and shout at people, you know, I don't really want to operate here. I mean, I've had enough blood.
Gitan cigarettes play an important part in your book, Besieged. You not only smoke them a lot, you hand them out a lot. And it's funny, you know, doctors are always warning us how we shouldn't smoke and so on, and every day there's new evidence about the dangers of smoking. Does that not bother you because you're so exposed to more immediate dangers?
Well, obviously, I mean, my cliche answer is when you have to dodge stray bullets, I mean, who cares about smoking at that point? You take calculated risks in a war zone. You try to avoid stupid risks. I mean, just being in a war zone is a calculated risk. So is walking in certain parts of Washington, D.C. Or L.A. or New York.
Or Philadelphia.
Or Philadelphia. Crossing the street in Rome is a calculated risk. So, yes, I mean, I think the important thing, whether it's smoking, drinking, eating salt, cholesterol, etc., jogging, and so on, aerobics, that one accepts one's own mortality. We are all of us going to die one day, at least once. And I think that people have difficulty dealing with that. I mean, it's a very, very late 20th century narcissistic Western attitude that me, and I have to live, and I have to have all of this, and I have to do it, and I have to have it. And I don't want to die, but you will, one day.
And you feel like you've accepted your mortality?
So if you accept your mortality, for me, it also means that you've accepted life. People who refuse their mortality are the people who are refusing life. And I think it's a philosophical point of view. It has nothing to do with epidemiology. It has everything to do with philosophy and why one lives to begin with. Why would you want to live another 10 years if you're bored with your life?
Just quickly, does this help explain why you're always putting your life on the line?
That was not the original intent, and certainly I don't think it's continued to be that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I would call myself a very existentialist type of person. And I still like to read Camus. And you really have to make your life on a day-to-day basis, and you have to make the decisions daily of why I should not commit suicide today. What reason have I given myself for living today? And you go on from there.
Dr. Yano, good luck to you, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Chris Yano, recorded in February of this year. After we spoke, the International Committee of the Red Cross assigned him to Afghanistan. Since early November, he's been in Burundi in Central Africa, heading the Red Cross surgical team. Dr. Yano is the author of a memoir called Besieged. He spells his last name G-I-A-N-N-O-U. That's G-I-A-N-N-O-U. Tomorrow we continue our series of interviews with some of the more remarkable people who joined us in 1993. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Amy Sallet. Our program is produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Tui, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two women writers talk about their lives, their work, and the spirituality that sustains them. We hear from Catholic and feminist Nancy Mayers and Chilean novelist Isabel Allende. It's part of our 1993 Fresh Air retrospective. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.